Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Start today's show with our segment, Media Watch, where we look at how the media portrays public health issues. My eye was caught when I was looking through the paper, and I see a full-page ad by Mercy Health, which is basically a recruitment ad for nurses and such. And it closes by saying, if it is your calling to provide compassionate quality care, join the team at Mercy Health, where nurses and support staff mean the world. Mean the world. That's a great sentiment. I couldn't help but notice a couple times as I rode my bike by St. Vincent's that there is a nursing strike. And there were 100 plus people out there, striking. For several things, largely for the mandatory overtime that they're required to serve with extra shifts they have no control over, which is a way for Mercy Health to save money rather than hiring more people. But this is also very dangerous for both the nurses and the patients. Also, in their expired contract, nurses were not able to have any control over their premiums, that Mercy Health can unilaterally increase those costs, so they won't include that in there, which I find a little bit ironic, since people that are providing health care have to struggle to get good health care, affordable health care coverage. Also, I find this particularly ironic as we're celebrating the last week of Mental Health Month, and nursing is a very, very stressful job, and they take care of us. We should take care of them. Mercy Health, shame on you. Settle this strike and take care of the nurses so that we can get the care we need and that nurses can get the care they need to maintain their own health. Let's make the practice of health care a good example of healthy living. And in that vein, from Science Daily, long work hours of intern year associated with accelerated shortening of telomere regions of chromosomes. In just a few short weeks, tens of thousands of newly minted doctors will start the most intense year of their training, the first year of residency, also called the intern year. A new study suggests that between now and next summer, that experience will make their DNA age six times faster than normal, and the effect will be largest among those training programs demanding the longest hours. The findings about the effect of residency focus on the stretch of DNA called telomeres, which keep the ends of chromosomes intact like the plastic end of shoelaces. The discovery that telomeres shrink in an accelerated way among interns suggests the importance of ongoing efforts to reduce the strain of medical training. But the researchers say their study also holds implication for other professions and situations that expose people to prolonged stress and months of long hours. Research has implicated telomeres as an indicator of aging and disease risk. I'll also remind you that doctors are the profession with the highest suicide rate, so that's something we should consider during Mental Health Month. Oh my goodness. Okay, well, sticking with the theme of mental health, here on Just for the Health of It, we occasionally feature local poets expounding on public health-related themes. Last week, we debuted the first in a series of poems on mental health by local poet Justin Sampson. Justin's creative work often explores and attempts to destigmatize mental illness. Here is Justin's poem in his own voice on PS, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
PTSD, part one, war. As I lay in bed trying to sleep, I see the images that have been ingrained in my head. The boy that ran from us, only to step on an IED, turning into a bloody cloud. The images of heads being blown apart, a watermelon with a firecracker in it. Images of bodies in positions they should not be in, over and over again. The only way I sleep now is through the bottom of this whiskey bottle. I signed up to protect our country, not a lifetime of pictures. I stop at a stoplight, a car backfires, and suddenly I'm back in the firefight. The audible yelling, screaming, bullets whizzing past us, ricocheting off my Humvee. Suddenly a great trumpet sound brings me back to reality. The guy behind me honking and yelling at me. The light's green. My son stalks me and jumps out. All I see is an enemy, and in a split second I must decide, his life or mine. I grab him by the throat and throw him to the ground, only to realize this is my son I just threw to the ground. I can't do this anymore. I never know what's reality or what's real. Reality weaves into dreams seamlessly. There is only one way to ensure I don't hurt anyone. It's to report one last time for a suicide mission. Reporting for duty. Part 2. Life. The decisions I have made and the decisions that were made for me haunt me. At night, I lie awake, remembering the innocence I have destroyed and the innocence stolen from me. A lion picking the bones of his prey, a dead horse taking a beating. A thousand sorries, the song of my soul, never saves me from this prison. The still images, the poor quality movie projector playing on the inside of my skull. Regrets like shadows, always closely behind.
Thanks for sharing your poem, Justin. And continuing with the theme of Mental Health Month, Ohio's suicide rate jumps 24% from 2008 to 2017. This from the Columbus Dispatch. The suicide rate among men is 4 times higher than women. Rates increased 80% among children 14 and younger, and 57% for Ohioans 60 and older. The highest average annual suicide rates were among white Ohioans. Rate increases were more significant in rural and suburban areas than in Appalachian and metropolitan areas, and firearms accounted for about half of all suicides. Continuing with the suicide theme, from Bloomberg, as suicides rise, insurers find ways to deny mental health coverage. Red tape and lack of in-network providers frustrate those seeking treatment. The U.S. is in the midst of a mental health crisis. In 2017, 47,000 Americans died by suicide and 70,000 from drug overdoses, and 17.3 million adults suffered at least one major depressive episode. The Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, a landmark law passed more than a decade ago, requires insurers to provide comparable coverage for mental health and medical treatments. Even so, insurers are denying claims, limiting coverage, and finding other ways to avoid complying with the law. Failures of the mental health system contributed to trends that have lowered U.S. life expectancy over the past 3 years. From 2008, when Congress passed the Parity Act, to 2016, the rate at which Americans died by suicide increased 16%. The rate of fatal overdoses jumped 66% in the same period. The health insurers are not following the federal law requiring parity in the reimbursement for mental health and addiction, President Trump's Commission on the Opioid Crisis wrote in its report in November 2017. They must be held responsible. In 2010, the Affordable Care Act became law, mandating that commercial health insurance plans offer mental health benefits. Combined with the Parity Act, federal law appeared to guarantee that Americans would have access to mental health services like never before. And there are signs the laws have helped. A federal report published in February 2019 concluded that the law increased the use of outpatient addiction treatment services, and for those already getting mental health care, the frequency of their visits. But patients and their families say insurers use more subtle methods to stint on treatment. Their directories of providers are padded with clinicians who don't take new patients or are no longer in an insurer's coverage network. They request piles of paperwork before approving treatment. They pay mental health clinicians less than other medical professions for similar services. Patients frequently complain of ghost networks, insurance directories full of clinicians listed as in-network who aren't contracted with the plan. It all adds up to a wall between people and the help they need, the kind of barrier that would never be tolerated if the illness were diabetes or leukemia. You have parity coverage on paper, says Angela Kimball, Chief Executive Officer of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, but if you can't find an in-network provider in your coverage, it can become meaningless for you if you can't afford care or find it. Patients are going out of network for behavioral health care significantly more than for medical and surgical care, which typically means they're paying more. Behavioral health providers get lower reimbursements than medical providers. Primary care medical doctors make 20% more for a basic office visit, for example, than psychiatrists do. Higher reimbursements would lead to better access for patients. How can insurers continue to violate the letter and spirit of the law? Partly because the Parity Act sets ambiguous standards, advocates say, and doesn't have teeth. The federal rules don't say how to measure whether a health plan's network of mental health providers is sufficient, for example. So the insurers have discretion over what they deem as an adequate network. More importantly, there's no one agency or office responsible for enforcing the rules. The relevant authority may be the U.S. Department of Labor, or the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or a state insurance regulator, depending on the health plan. At the state level, enforcement varies widely and rarely leads to large financial penalties. Next up from Stat News, has your insurer denied a medical claim? Stand up for your rights. By knowing their rights, appealing denials, and fighting back, patients can stand up for themselves. But first, they need to know that is an option. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation report looked at data on claim denials and appeals from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Among other findings, the report showed that consumers rarely appeal claims that have been denied. In 2017, 121 major health insurers denied a total of more than 42 million claims. Consumers appealed less than 200,000, or 0.05% of these denials. Although the consumers have the right to bypass their insurer's internal appeals process and go directly to an external review, this happens in fewer than 1 in 11,000 denied claims, which is 0.009%. Not appealing is a lost opportunity. A recent report by the California Chronic Care Coalition, Standing Up for Your Rights Creates Results, showed that the California Department of Managed Health Care reversed or overturned 61% of health plan decisions in 2017. This finding shows that consumers can get coverage for the care they need after appealing. No one should take their health plan's denial as arbitrary and final, especially now. Just last month, United Health Group lost a class action suit filed by 50,000 patients because one of its arms, United Behavioral Health, denied coverage for mental and behavioral health issues. Everyone should be equipped with the tools necessary to stand up for their rights. MyPatientsRights.org is a place where consumers can find those tools and learn how to use them. At the end of the day, people whose health insurance claims have been denied must know they have options and are not alone. Again, that website, MyPatientRights.org. MyPatientRights.org. Feel free to check it out. Now I'd like to switch gears and talk about a study which some are hailing as a landmark study in nutrition. This as reported by Consumer Reports. Processed foods are bad for weight loss, study shows. You've probably heard the message that fresh whole foods are healthier for you than processed packaged ones. But some processed foods are worse for you than others. Studies have linked diets that include lots of foods considered ultra-processed to an increased risk of cancer and early death. And experts think that our increased consumption of these foods over the past 50 years has something to do with the rising obesity rates over the same period. A new study shows that eating an ultra-processed diet versus a whole food one, one rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, lean meats, increases calorie consumption and leads to weight gain. The study is notable in that it is the first randomized controlled trial, the kind of study thought to be the best for assessing cause and effect relationships, to compare these two types of diets. In addition, the researchers designed the two diets so that the calories, fat, fiber, sugars, protein, and other nutrients would closely match. The purpose of our study was to try to answer the question of whether it's the nutrient composition of the foods or something about the processing of them that's leading people to overeat, says the lead study author Kevin Hall, a senior investigator at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. I thought if we matched for those nutrients, there would be very little difference in calorie intake. I was wrong. Ultra-processed has no set definition, either among scientists or by a regulatory agency like the Food and Drug Administration. For the purposes of this study, the researchers used a food classification system developed by scientists in Brazil called NOVA. This system groups foods into four categories, from unprocessed or minimally processed to ultra-processed. Ultra-processed foods are those with long lists of ingredients that include things like added sugar, salt, dyes, flavorings, emulsifiers, and high fructose corn syrup. They are designed to be tasty, plus they are cheap, convenient, and easy to make. We know that ultra-processed foods contain lots of refined carbohydrates, added sugars, fat, and salt, says Ki Soon, MD, an assistant professor of nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. That combination is highly palatable, and it can promote overeating. Though, both diets were rated by the study subjects as equally palatable. So why do we overeat ultra-processed foods? There are many theories about why we tend to consume more calories when we eat ultra-processed foods. It could simply be because they're cheap, tasty, and require little or no work to go from package to plate. But findings from the new study suggest it might be more than that. One interesting result is that we saw changes in some of the hormones involved in appetite regulation. While eating the whole food diet, levels of an appetite-suppressing hormone increased significantly and levels of the hunger hormone decreased. There could be something about how the gut processes whole foods that supports these beneficial hormonal changes. In addition, people in the study ate the ultra-processed foods faster than they did the unprocessed ones, to the tune of about 17 more calories per minute. It could be that many ultra-processed foods included in the study require less effort to eat than the unprocessed foods subjects were given. It can take a lot more time to chew and break down whole foods compared with highly refined processed foods. And when you eat food more quickly, your brain doesn't get the signal that you're full fast enough. The bottom line? Eat more whole foods. Even if all the reasons why are still unclear, this study does indicate that a diet of ultra-processed foods leads to weight gain. The best advice is to limit your intake of ultra-processed foods as much as possible. But he also cautions against getting too caught up in whether it's better to eat a diet that's low-carb, high-protein, keto, paleo, etc. Instead, he urges people to focus on the quality of the food they eat. What all healthy diets have in common is they are emphasizing eating whole, unprocessed foods, like fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. It should be fairly easy to recognize and ideally avoid most ultra-processed foods. Start by looking at the ingredients on the package and eliminate anything with a long list of things that sound more like chemicals than food. Wow. Well, this is related to what I talked about in an earlier show, what I call the great diluters in our diet, which is added fats, added sugars, and lots of refined grains. This plus the liberal use of salt contributes to overeating and poor nutrition. Food manufacturers are really good at designing foods to get us to eat more. In fact, in a future show, I may talk about this food science paper that's really incredible. Maybe drill down into some of the detail about how they're able to manufacture foods that sell. What I found the most interesting point in this study really was that both diets were related equally palatable. So you don't really need to sacrifice palatability. You just need to avoid the highly processed manufactured foods that take advantage of what may be things below our consciousness that actually get us to eat more. But not having to sacrifice some palatability is a huge issue in people making changes in their diet. Okay, now let's get to the official public health news and research roundup.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, This public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, some Ohio news. Ohio joins price-fixing lawsuit against generic drug makers. This from Health Policy News. Attorney generals from more than 40 states, including Ohio, are alleging the nation's largest generic drug manufacturers conspired to artificially inflate and manipulate prices for more than 100 generic drugs, including treatments for diabetes, cancer, arthritis, and other medical conditions. The lawsuit filed in federal court also named 15 individual senior executives responsible for sales, marketing, and pricing. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost stated, "Ohioans who need medicine might think generic drugs would be their cheapest option, but some manufacturers have rigged the system to avoid competition. That's not how a free market works, and the conspiracy to avoid competition makes prices higher, and it's against the law. This lawsuit is the prescription for lower medicine prices in a free market." Now for some local news. This from the Toledo Blade, an editorial, "We've been warned about algae. When we all went three scary days without drinkable water in Toledo back in 2014, most people probably thought that crisis was alarming enough to prompt a speedy solution to the Lake Erie algae problem. 5 years later, scientists are warning that a rainy spring this year does not bode well for this summer's algae threat. The season's first forecast is that the algae blooms will likely be more severe than last year. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts a bloom that will register greater than 5 on its 10-point scale of severity. The prediction is a yearly practice that began after the 2014 crisis, during which algae toxin fouled the city's water supply. And what have we accomplished since 2014 to address the threat of those algae blooms? What have we done to prevent another water crisis? Not much, unless you count the annual algae forecasting. We don't have pollution limits on agricultural runoff that flows from the Maumee River watershed into the lake, feeding the algae blooms. We have made no measurable progress towards cutting the amount of phosphorus pouring out into the lake, despite the fact that Ohio signed onto a multi-state goal of reducing the levels by 20% by next year and 40% by 2025. We haven't made plans to build a second water intake in the lake. Toledo still has just one intake. If another toxic bloom, even a very small one, parks itself over that intake, as it did in 2014, Toledo's water system does not have another intake through which to draw lake water to serve its 500,000 customers. Are we still going to be dreading the news of a bad algae forecast 5 summers from now? At this rate, it seems plausible. We lack the will to get real about what is threatening our region's drinking water, our fishing and tourism industries, our economic development, and our quality of life. The algae is coming again. Get ready for another summer of dread, of watching the sickly green blooms grow on the lake surface. When will it be enough to motivate us to get serious about solving the algae problem, instead of just forecasting it?" Okay, and sticking with environmental news, this from sciencemag.org, "Why some climate scientists are saying no to flying. In 2016, two seemingly unrelated events conspired to make Kim Cobb confront her personal carbon footprint. First, a massive El Nino event hit the coral reef researchers' 22-year study site, warming the ocean to record levels and killing 85% of the reefs. During her first scuba dive afterward, I was crying in my mask," says Cobb, a professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology. "It's one thing to read papers about coral bleaching, but when it happens to a place where you know every dive like the back of your hand, it's something different." Then a few months later, her hope for government action to tackle climate change was extinguished when Donald Trump was elected U.S. president. So she started to do a rigorous accounting of the carbon that she's responsible for emitting, finding that air travel accounted for a whopping 85% of her carbon footprint in 2017. She'd flown roughly 200,000 kilometers that year, mostly to conferences. She vowed that 2018 would be different. "Flying is a luxury and a privilege that must be reserved for a fraction of the events that we use it for right now," she argues. Cobb is one of a small but growing minority of academics who are cutting back on their air travel because of climate change. Traveling to conferences, lectures, workshops, and the like, frequently by plane, is often viewed as crucial for scientists to exchange information and build community. But Cobb and others are questioning that perspective, pushing conferences to provide more opportunities to participate remotely and changing their personal behavior to do their part in confronting the climate change crisis. On a website called No Fly Climate Sci, for example, roughly 200 academics, many of them climate scientists, have pledged to fly as little as possible since the effort started in 2017. Cobb, for her part, started to ask conference and institutional representatives who invited her to speak whether she could do so remotely. About three-quarters of the time, they agreed. When the answer was no, she declined the invitation. That approach brought Cobb's 2018 air travel down by 75%, and she plans to continue the practice. It has been incredibly rewarding, she says, a really positive change. As she sees it, it's not about just reducing their own footprint. It's also about setting an example. It's inevitable that the public looks to us, that is climate scientists, to gauge the urgency of the situation. If you're walking the talk, then the public will see you as a more trusted messenger of the urgency of climate change. Yes, if we want to live in a world with a low carbon footprint, one of the things we need to do is to align our lives living a low carbon footprint. Thank you, Kim Cobb. Next up from The Guardian, revealed air pollution may be damaging every organ in the body. Air pollution may be damaging every organ and virtually every cell in the human body, according to a comprehensive new global review. The research shows head-to-toe harm, from heart and lung disease to diabetes and dementia, and from liver problems and bladder cancer to brittle bones and damaged skin. Fertility, fetuses, and children are also affected by toxic air. Air pollution is a public health emergency, according to the World Health Organization, with more than 90% of the global population enduring toxic outdoor air. New analysis indicates 8.8 million early deaths each year, double earlier estimates, making air pollution a bigger killer than tobacco smoking. The World Health Organization has called air pollution the silent killer because its widespread effects are not ascribed to toxic air. The harmful effects of dirty air shown in review begin when the pollution is inhaled. This results in breathing problems, from asthma to emphysema to lung cancer. There's now overwhelming evidence that air pollution results in serious harm not only to the lungs, but also to the heart. Here it increases the risk of heart attacks as arteries narrow and muscles weaken. One reason for the wide-ranging damage from air pollution is that very small particles can penetrate the lungs and be carried around the body. They land in the organs directly. Strokes, dementia, and reduced intelligence are all conditions affecting the brain that have been linked to air pollution. There's also evidence that poor sleep can be a consequence of breathing toxic air. The main reason for the far-reaching damage from air pollution is systemic inflammation. Immune cells think a pollution particle is a bacteria, go after it, and try to kill it by releasing enzymes and acids. Those inflammatory proteins spread into the body, affecting the brain, the kidneys, the pancreas, and so forth. In evolutionary terms, the body has evolved to defend itself against infections, not pollution. Research highlighted in review also links air pollution to numerous cancers, including in the bladder and the gut, where an increase in irritable bowel syndrome has also been found. Even skin and bones are affected, with skin aging, hives, and brittle bones associated with toxic air. Perhaps the most disturbing impact of toxic air is the damage to reproduction and children. Fertility is reduced and miscarriages increase by exposure to air pollution. The unborn are also affected, with a recent study finding pollutants in the placentas that nourish fetuses. Air pollution is also strongly linked to low birth weights for babies, which has lifelong consequences. Children are especially vulnerable, the review found, as their bodies are still developing. Particularly compelling evidence comes from three types of study, where air pollution and illness change in tandem over time, where the dose of pollution correlates with levels of disease, and from animal studies. For example, government action to slash pollution before the Beijing Olympics in 2008 led to a rise in birth weights in the city, which is a good thing. Harmful effects occur even at levels below air quality standards previously considered to be safe, warn the review scientists, who between them represent every continent. But they add, the good news is that the problem of air pollution can be addressed. The best way to reduce exposure is to control it at its source. Most air pollution comes from burning fossil fuels to generate electricity, heat homes, and power transport. And so, what are we doing about this here in the United States? Oh, let's check it out from the New York Times. EPA plans to get thousands of deaths off the books by changing its math. The Environmental Protection Agency plans to change the way it calculates the future health risks of air pollution, a shift that would predict thousands of fewer deaths and would help justify the planned rollback of a key climate change measure, according to five people with knowledge of the agency's plans. The proposed change would dramatically reduce the 1,400 additional premature deaths per year that the EPA had initially forecast as a result of eliminating the old climate change regulation. The Clean Power Plan, which was President Barack Obama's signature climate change action measure. It would also make it easier for the administration to defend its replacement, known as the Affordable Clean Energy Rule. The new modeling method, which experts said has never been peer-reviewed and is not scientifically sound, would most likely be used by the Trump administration to defend further rollbacks of air pollution rules. The proposed new modeling method is unusual because it relies on unfounded medical assumptions and discards more than a decade of peer-reviewed EPA methods for understanding the health hazards linked to the fine particulate matter produced by burning fossil fuels. Fine particulate matter, the tiny deadly particles that can penetrate deep into the lungs and enter the bloodstream, is linked to heart attacks, strokes, and respiratory disease. And, of course, as in the previous story, to much, much more. From Yale.edu, dangerously high air pollution levels found in most U.S. national parks. So don't think you can get away from it by running away from the city, people. Some 85% of U.S. national parks have levels of air pollution that are hazardous to human health. In 88% of parks, air pollution is having a direct impact on sensitive species or habitat, such as stifling tree growth, damaging leaves, and changing soil and water chemistry. Much of the air pollution comes from nearby oil and gas drilling sites, coal mines, power plants, vehicles, and agricultural activities. The report reinforces the findings of a study published last year, which found that over the last two decades, air pollution in U.S. national parks has rivaled pollution levels in the country's 20 largest metropolitan areas, including Los Angeles and Houston. And let's take it home with one last story from Global News Canada. Montreal redefines the term butthead in bid to cut down on pollution. The city of Montreal is redefining the word butthead in a bid to keep city streets clean and cut down on pollution. In a new social media campaign, the city defines a butthead as someone who throws their cigarette butts on the ground. Cigarette butts represent 30% of the waste the city picks up. Their toxic residue poisons our environment. And then they ask the critical question, what do you do when you see someone being buttheaded? On its website, the city explains that just one cigarette butt can contain up to 7,000 toxic chemicals, and if thrown on the ground, it can pollute up to 500 liters of water. Officials are hoping residents will do what's right for the environment and discard their cigarettes in ashtrays. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.